أشهد أن محمد رسول
الله. Assalamu alaikum, peace be on you. Welcome back to another episode of Islam in Focus. Today we have our ninth program in our discussion of the Quran and modern sciences. We'll be continuing with our very interesting discussion of human reproduction in the Quran. I have joining me on the program as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Looking forward to another interesting program on this most interesting subject. So perhaps have you very quickly, before we get into today's discussion, highlight the main points we touched on in our program last week?
Certainly. The first point we discussed last time was to discuss what the Quran mentioned in Surah 13 about the increase and decrease in the womb or uterus. And we indicated again that the wording of the Quran does not seem to refer only to the changes due to pregnancy, but also to something that has been discovered recently or relatively recently with respect to the change of the thickness of the uterus in the various stages of the development of the female, and also to the increase and decrease during the monthly cycle. Secondly, we focused also on the role of the male in the process of fertilization, and we referred to what the Quran mentioned in Surah 76 about the creation of the human from nutfatin amshajin in Arabic, which means mingled liquid. And again, we indicated that this refers to the mingling of the contribution of both the husband and the wife, and we indicated that this process of fertilization using both, that is the what you call today the ovum and the sperm, is something that has not been quite understood except in the 19th century, and that was more than 1,000 years after the revelation of the Quran. There are amazing other things pertaining to fertilization, which we have also discussed from the scientific standpoint. And the last point we were talking about is that out of nearly 200 to 300 million sperms emitted in a single intimate relationship between husband and wife, only one of them, one sperm, normally fertilizes the ovum.
Mm-hmm. There's another very interesting question that is triggered by our discussion, and which has to do with the fact that there are millions of sperm,
hundreds of millions
of sperm, and yet there's only one ovum. Why is that? And why is it that the ovum is so much larger than the sperm?
Okay. Well, to start with, the sperms, even though they are plentiful in number, first of all, not all of them are good enough for fertilization. An estimated 20% are no good for fertilization, to start with. Secondly, another group of sperms or number of them, perhaps even another 20%, would normally die within just a few hours, a period which is not quite enough to reach the ovum and fertilize it. The other reason is that, as we know, there are two fallopian tubes, and the ovum is emitted once a month from one side, the next month from the other side. So it's quite possible also that a number of sperms would go through the wrong fallopian tube after it gets through the uterus, then it might go to the wrong fallopian tube where there is no ovum available for fertilization. That means that the number that reaches the ovum actually would be in the hundreds rather than in the hundreds of millions. If you might recall from the previous program when we had the slide showing the ovum and the sperms around it, we said only about 400 to 500 sperms reach actually the ovum. And then out of this, only one is admitted, the others just disintegrate, and their disintegration actually softened the wall and helped the chosen sperm, if you will, to enter or to pierce the ovum. As far as the question of the size and why the ovum is much larger, the reason is that she acts also as a host, really. Because in the initial stage of the primary cells, beginning of division, the ovum provides actually the nutrients needed until such time that the zygote, as they call it, comes and starts to cling to the wall of the uterus and gets its nutrition through the mother. So in the initial stage, they need some nutrition. That's why the ovum is considerably large. There's also, just to make a footnote here, there's also a sort of process of selection also in the case of the ovum. For example, it is estimated that a fetus, a male female fetus, may have as many as 6 million ovums or ova. And then by the time, of course, that she become adolescent, most of these will die, and only 30,000 remains. And out of these, only about maybe 400 become functional, the ones that come throughout the adult life of the female. And again, not each one of these 400 gets fertilized, as you know. So again, there you go. So there's a process of selection. But of course, the selection in the case of the sperms is really one out of hundreds of millions, really.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything in the Quran about fertilization which was not known or not commonly known at the time of its revelation?
Well, the answer first is yes. In fact, there is a clear indication in the Quran that only a very small amount, very tiny amount of the semen, if you will, is responsible for the fertilization. And I said that in view of the discussion that we had in the early programs on human reproduction, was not known until perhaps the 19th century and later. As far as the texts of the Quran that seem to give this indication, we find in more than one place, for example, in Surah 75, in passage 37, أَلَمْ يَكُ نُطْفَةً مِنْ مَنِيٍّ يُمْنَى. About the human, it says, was the human not a trickle, or you might say a very small drop or tiny drop of semen which is poured out? And this is not the only place in the Quran when a mention is made that it's only part of the semen or the sperm which fertilizes the ovum or is responsible for creation. For example, in Surah 16, in passage 4, that again says that the human was created from a trickle or a tiny drop of semen. The same kind of expression is repeated. Now, in understanding the expressions in the Quran, there are two key terms that are quite helpful. One is that the Quran used the term nutfa. And nutfa literally means something that dribbles or trickles, something very tiny. Actually, they give examples of that, of what happens when you empty a container, a water container, for example. After you empty every last drop of water, there may still remain very tiny thing in the bottom of the container. So this is what the word nutfa means, something very, very tiny, very small. The second term used in the Quran is the term mani. And mani, the closest translation actually would be really semen, or the fluids, the male fluid. Now, the text of the Quran says that the human is created from this nutfa, or from that dribble of, or out of, the semen, which means that not all the semen is needed really for fertilization, or doesn't fertilize, because there's only one sperm, as we have indicated earlier. And we said that this is not really something that was known scientifically in the 7th century of the Common Era. But there's another ayah in the Quran, or passage, which is even more amazing. And I was talking to a sister who is an American doctor, Mrs. Ahmed, on this issue, and she was really struck by the expression of the Quran, and that is the term sulala. Mm-hmm. In the Quran it says, in Surah 8, in passage 32, ثم جعل نسله من سلالة من ماء مهين, that after the human was created from dust, the original pair of male and female, Allah made the progeny of the first couple, that is, from the sulala, which means extract of a despised liquid. Despised liquid here is a reference to the semen. But the striking expression here is the term extract. because literally in Arabic, sulala means something that's extracted or the best of the thing, which means that not all of it is mm-hmm. something chosen and selected out of that small amount of liquid. And this kind of understanding is not really stretching the meaning of the Quran at all, because as we know, the saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, actually is the explanation of the Quran, because he was receiving also revelation. And in one of his saying, he said very clearly, ما من كل ماء يخلق الولد, that is to say that the progeny is not created from the whole of the fluid. He is referring to the fluid of the human, of the male, that is to say the semen. And this information definitely is rather amazing in view of the state of knowledge
mm-hmm.
in the time of revelation.
I'd like to turn now to another aspect of human reproduction, and that is in an interesting area of the determination of the sex of the mm-hmm. embryo. Mm-hmm. Is there any reference to that in the Quran?
This is another stunning and amazing area also of what the Quran speaks about, because the Quran is clear that the sex of the embryo is determined actually by the sperm, that is by the male contribution, the male side. And this kind of text that we find in the Quran can only be appreciated if we have some understanding of the background from the scientific standpoint
mm-hmm.
as to how the sex of the fetus or the embryo is determined, because I'm sure many of the viewers perhaps might need this kind of clarification to start with. To begin with, the human body, the basic structure of the human body is composed of cells, as you know, billions and billions of those cells. Now, in each human cell, there is a nucleus. And inside that nucleus, there are 46 chromosomes. The chromosomes are simply things which carry the hereditary characteristic of the human. Now, when the human cell, as you know, the cells keep dividing.
Mm-hmm.
When the human cell begins to divide, these chromosomes become distinct, as we see in this illustration, that you could see 23 pairs of those chromosomes. Actually, each two of them are joined together. So we talk here about really 46 in the form of 23 pairs of those chromosomes. Now, in 1953, two scientists by the name of Crick and Watson discovered the chemical composition of those chromosomes, and actually as a result they won the Nobel Prize for their research, which is a very important and revolutionary discovery in the study of genetics. What they found is that the chemical basis for those chromosomes are basically the basic chemical structure is composed of a nucleic acid called DNA. Now, this acid acts actually as the brain, more or less, that controls the activities of the cell. It's almost like the head of the cell, or its brain.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you develop that a little bit more, so perhaps we can get a little thorough appreciation of why the DNA is so important?
Well, its main importance is that Allah created this nucleic acid in such a way that it can really control all the activities of the cell. It's just like a computer program, really.
Mm-hmm.
The computer program for the cell. And as scientists say, it has a very complex sort of secrets or codes which determine the activities of the cell. Now, as you know, the human body is all composed of cells. However, we have so many different organs. What determines that one cell becomes a liver cell, an eye cell, an eardrum cell, a hair cell. Mm-hmm. These are basically the characteristics which are determined through this DNA, so that the DNA actually determines that this cell shall grow in that particular form or this color or that particular characteristic. Furthermore, the DNA, that nucleic acid, determines also the types of enzymes which are to be secreted, the characteristics of those enzymes. But the strange thing also about it is that it is programmed time-wise. In other words, there are certain functions of the cell that take place only in a given period of time. Example, a baby, for example, a baby boy may have the testicles. But again, God or Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created that code in the DNA so that it would not start producing sperms, for example, except in one particular point of time. That's when the boy becomes an adolescent male. The same thing for the female ovaries, the hair growth, for example. So these are not only determination of the way the cell should function, but also the time when it should grow in a particular manner or perform certain functions. This control applied by the DNA is achieved actually through another messenger, another nucleic acid. They refer to as the RNA, standing for ribonucleic acid. That RNA actually carries the orders, if you will, the commands or messages from the DNA to the cell so that it can start producing whatever enzymes or whatever specific form or forms of many thousands and thousands of proteins that the cell may be able to produce. So it's a highly complex thing. I hope I tried to put it in a reasonably simplified form, but it's basically this sort of control of activities, basically.
I suppose many people would wonder how something that's so tiny as a DNA could determine such complex functions and operations, you know, all the complex combinations of proteins.
Yes, it's indeed stunning, but perhaps one approximate way of explaining it would be to raise a similar question. How could a silicon computer chip, very tiny one, determine also the program and the way the computer, for example, performs certain operations? The main reason is that, again, there are certain codes or instructions, if you will, that are contained in this thing, tiny as it may be. Of course, we're not comparing the computer chips with the nucleic acid. We talk about something very, very microscopic. It's just with approximation to help understand it. But the other way also of looking at it is that, as we mentioned earlier, that that nucleic acid, the DNA, is composed of four nitrogenous bases. Okay? Now, as Dr. Muhammad Al-Bahr explained, he said, suppose you take each of these nitrogenous bases as a letter. It means that you have four letters. And he said if you wanted to compose various words of these letters, that's three-letter words, you could have as many as 64 words. Now, each of these nitrogenous bases control also 20 amino acids. So when you have that combination, you can have almost infinite number of combinations that you could have, and that's why you could have thousands of possible types of proteins, just with this basic nitrogenous basis. To put it in a simpler way that anyone can relate to, if you go to any library, for example, you may find millions and millions of books in thousands of topics, and there are tens of thousands of words. Even though, for example, in the English language, there's only a few letters. You were talking about 27 alphabets. But because of these various combinations of those letters together, you can have tens of thousands of different words. So it's a strange thing about this secret of creation and the code that directs everything in the proper function, proper timing, that shows the hand of the Creator, really, in all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to the question of determination of the sex, we'll go back to the chromosomes that you were talking about earlier. How do they determine the sex of the embryo?
Okay. Maybe you can go back to the notion that we just discussed earlier, that the whole body is composed of cells. Each cell is composed of, or inside each cell, there is the nucleus. Inside the nucleus, there are the 46 chromosomes. And as indicated earlier again, that these chromosomes, when the cell begins to divide, they become distinct and they appear in pairs, just to begin with. Now, it should be indicated here that when we relate this notion of chromosomes and their role to the process of fertilization,
mm-hmm.
then we should bring to mind that the ovum and the sperm, both of them, which are responsible, of course, for the initial development of the embryo, are both cells. Maybe they are special cells, but essentially what they are is they are cells resulting from a sort of cell division.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But the strange thing, again, is that the female cell is slightly different from the male cell.
Mm-hmm.
How? The female cell includes or contains in the normal way the 46 chromosomes or 23 pairs, but only one of those pairs is responsible for the sex of the individual. In other words, the 23rd pair of chromosomes in the case of a female is known as XX. Usually X chromosome is used to refer to female, Y chromosome is used to refer to male characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of the female cell, that 23rd pair of chromosomes is both X, that's XX. Mm-hmm. All right? Now, in the male chromosome, on the other hand, that's the 23rd pair of chromosomes in the male cell, we find that it's different. It is XY. In other words, half of it, or one of those chromosomes, that pair, is an X chromosome, which means it carries the female nature. The other one is Y, which means it carries the male characteristic. Now, when the female cell divides in order to produce the ovum, because you said the ovum actually comes as, you know, as a result of the division of the cells inside the ovaries of the female, we find that even if it splits into half, then each half would have 23 chromosomes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But since the 23rd pair of chromosomes are both X or female, that means you'd have all female. In other words, all ova produced by the female carry the female characteristic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, on the other hand, when the male cell divides to produce the sperm, as you mentioned before, this takes place in the testicle. When that division takes place, the situation is different. Because what happened is that the 23rd chromosome, which is responsible for the sex of the embryo, is not symmetric. In other words, there is X and Y, as you see in that illustration. In the right-hand corner, you notice that the last pair in the very lower part is actually not exactly the same, not identical. One of them, I'm talking about the lower ones that are apart from each other, one of them is or carries the X characteristic, that is the female characteristic. The other one carries the Y characteristic, so there is XY. Now, when that cell divides, it means that one of those new cells will contain the X chromosome, that is the one that carries the female characteristic,
mm-hmm.
whereas the other half or the other cell would carry the other half, which is the Y chromosome, because you see the 23 pairs just divide so that you have 23 single chromosomes in each sperm. This resulted in something drastically different from the ovum
mm-hmm.
of the female. It means that not all sperms are the same. the same. You see, all ova are all female, but not all sperms carry the same characteristics. So half of the sperms, roughly,
male.
Exactly, more or less, you can say half of them carry male characteristic, half carry female characteristic. Now, in the process of fertilization, what happens is that the nuclei of both the sperm and the ovum, unite. So the chromosomes get next to you, get again 23 pairs rather than just 23 single ones. So it makes a big difference now. And the only difference here is determined by the sperm. Because if a sperm that carries the female characteristic, that is the X chromosome, unite with the ovum, which always has the X chromosome, the result would be what?
Female,
that's XX.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if the sperm which carries the Y chromosome, that is the male characteristic, unite with the ovum, which always carries the X, that means you have XY or YX. That would be a male. And this is something that has been proven by science, that it is the sperm, actually, not the ovum, which is responsible for the dissemination of the sex of the fetus.
Mm-hmm. Well, the discussion that we've had so far has provided some very helpful background. But how do these scientific discoveries relate to what the Quran mentioned over 1,400 years ago?
Well, in more than one passage in the Quran, when it talks about the determination of male and female sex, it ties it, this expression, with the contribution of the male. Let me quote you one or two just to clarify the issue. For example, in Surah 53, in passages 45 through 46, وَأَنَّهُ خَلَقَ الزَّوْجَيْنِ الذَّكَرَ وَالْأُنْثَى مِنْ نُطْفَةٍ إِذَا تُمْنَى, that he, Allah, did create in pairs male and female from a small quantity of semen which is poured out, semen or sperm which is poured out. Notice here again, the use of the term mani or semen is definitely a reference to not the female contribution, but to the male contribution, exactly. At the same time, the passage starts about the creation of people in pairs, male and female. So the tying is there quite clearly between the sex, male or female, and the contribution of the male, not the female.
Yes.
See? And this is not the only passage in the Quran which makes this kind of tie. For example, another interesting citation in Surah 75, especially from Ayah 36 on, أَيَحْسَبُ الْإِنسَانُ أَنْ يُتْرَكَ سُدًى, does the human think that he or she will be left without purpose? Was he or she not a small quantity or a small drop of semen which is emitted or poured out? Then he or she became something that clings. Then did Allah fashion him or her in due proportion, and of it he made the two sexes, again it repeats, the male and the female. Has he not the power to bring the dead to life? Now, there are interesting things here on this particular passage. One, again, that it ties between the sex, or male or female, with the man contribution, like the previous passage. Secondly, it relates that also to the returning of the dead, because people say, how could billions of people die and then each one come as an individual in the day of judgment? And that might remind us what we mentioned last time, that there are also hundreds of billions of sperms, but only one fertilize the egg. So it draws our attention that Allah is able to return each person as an individual in the day of judgment. Similarly, in the Quran also we read in Surah 35 that Allah created us from dust, that is initially, and then from a small drop of sperm or semen, and then he made us as wazan, pairs, male and female.
Mm-hmm.
So in all of these we find a clear evidence in the Quran that it is the male that determines the sex of the fetus, something that definitely was not known at the time of the revelation of the Quran. For sure, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in the 7th century of the Common Era, did not have any electronic microscopes to examine these.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much, Brother Jamal. I've enjoyed the program immensely. I hope that you have enjoyed it as well. We want to thank you for watching. Join us next week. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.